Philosopher Jiddu Krishnamurti said, "You must understand the whole of life, not just one little part of it. That is why you must read. That is why you must look at the skies. That is why you must sing and dance and write poems and suffer and understand. For all that is life." This is the Producers Lounge Podcast. Welcome back for Season 2, Episode 5, hosted and produced by GreaterAndGrander.com. On this week's episode, we're chatting with Chicago native Tom Martin, who started his career traveling the country doing stand-up, and has written and produced on American classics, including The Simpsons, Saturday Night Live, and the PBS hit Word Girl. He now lives in Colorado, where he writes and pitches a variety of projects to companies around the world. Here now is my conversation with Tom Martin. Well, it's funny because I'm actually like a European mutt. I'm part Turkish, I'm part Transylvanian, like all over the place. So,
do you know this writer named Sergio Chili? Does some directing, comedy guy. Anyway, He did the 23andMe, and his parents are both from Italy. And he's very much identified as Italian, and he loves Italian soccer. He gets his results back. He's 40% Turkish.
That is great.
You know, I guess we're all a little bit mixed.
So yeah, thank you for being on the podcast.
Nice. That's a good way. I've done a lot of this with Todd Glass has a podcast, and I always fill in for his first choice of guest at last minute. Then he'll call me and I'll go over there. But yeah, it's the same thing. We just kind of talk.
So let me ask, where'd you grow up?
I was born in Chicago, and then you know how everybody's moving out of LA right now? Well, in 1974, everyone was moving from Midwestern cities, the Rust Belt, to this boom town in Los Angeles, where it was a lot of empty space, a lot of agriculture. And we came here, I guess I was going into fourth grade. And so then I went to, we moved to Palos Verdes. I went to Rolling Hills High School and then UC Irvine. And yeah, that's where I started doing comedy at UC Irvine. And
in fourth grade?
Or no. yeah, I probably thought I was funny in fourth grade. I think that I was never a very good student, but, and this is a pretty common thing, I think, is even the early days of Saturday Night Live, I would watch a sketch and then I would have it memorized, like word for word. Like the next day I would wake up and I could just roll out of my head perfectly. So I suppose if you're interested in something, you have this ability to learn it. Whereas something being taught to you at school that wasn't so funny was not as easy to learn. Or even when I got older, there was this, it was easy to remember comedy albums. You're too young for comedy albums, but we used to get this album, Steve Martin album, and put it on and play it and just sit there and just crack up.
Oh, nice. No, I was in the generation where we started getting CDs rather than vinyl. But yeah, that's really cool. Who are your favorite comedians growing up?
Well, I suppose Steve Martin in ninth grade. He was so huge. It's hard to even explain how big he was back then. I'm sure you've heard that.
Oh yeah.
You know, now people know him as a talented, funny guy, but he just he could fill arenas every night, and people knew the material he was going to play. And I think that he was so popular because really stand-up was not as accessible or available like it became, or even it is now. So the material that he plays, that he did then, maybe it's still funny to me, but might not hold up to this generation of, like your generation of comedy experts who have just seen an incredible amount of entertainment every which way. I mean, I think that the average person in America now your age could probably do stand up about as well as anybody in the 70s. Just could go up there and kill. In fact, I think that anybody who started stand up in the 70s became huge.
Oh,
It
wow.
was just booming. I mean,
It's
I
funny.
started in the late 80s, where it was still pretty easy to just make a living. There was just so much work.
Oh, wow. That's really funny because I did try stand up like a couple times in my life, and di obviously didn't pan out, but it was an interesting experience. I found it like nerve-wracking to perform in front of so
Yeah.
many people. Yeah.
Yes, I think it is. It, even though I did it as my main source of income for 10 years, it was still usually scary and terrifying for me. You know, I think you get used to it and you get used to masking it and you get used to knowing you have certain material you can fall back on that will almost always work. So you start looking less nervous on stage, but it wasn't easy for me. I think some people it was maybe easier. I would rather be a writer and just pass some material over to a more confident person to deliver it. Because then a lot of people say, "Hey, I just saw Todd do your joke, but he's one of my best friends." And I'm like, "He's running out of material. He can have any of them. I'm not using
That
it."
is very gracious of you. So then after these 10 years, you kind of at least from your IMDb page, you transitioned to being a writer at SNL. But then I also saw you worked on the Tom Arnold show for a little
Oh
while.
yeah, Tom Arnold had a couple of specials with HBO, and I think they were called The Naked Truth before The Naked Truth Show, which I also happened to work on. He had 3 half-hour specials that he was investigating topics. I forget the topics, but it was just a deal that Tom Arnold had. And yeah, I helped write one of them. I was good friends with Judd Apatow then, and he had too much work, so I would just hang out with him and just pick up his scraps, and which were a lot of scraps even then. And that's how I kind of learned the business. And he was learning it at the same time too. He just had really good representation and connections. So yeah, I think the reason I left stand-up is because I had a kid. My daughter was born in 92. My son was born in 94. And one day I was in a nightclub in Austin, Texas, doing stand and watching a comedian on stage doing stand up. And he's talking about his kids and his wife. And I got the sense that, boy, this guy shouldn't be out at a bar getting drunk and telling jokes. He should be home with his family. And then it occurred to me that I should also be home with my family, not in Texas, with all of this temptation and debauchery around. So I really made an effort to try and learn how to be a writer, which was no easy task because I don't know if I ever got an A in an English class in my life. So it was real. I started writing for, and maybe this is how I got the job with Tom Arnold. I started writing stand-up jokes for Roseanne and other people like Russian comedian Yakov Smirnoff, and gosh, I think who else? I don't know. I can't remember. But then that led into more sketch stuff, and there were some sketch shows that were short-lived, like one at ETV, E Entertainment Television, called News Weasels, that was a short-lived show. And then Judd was hired to be a guest writer at SNL for Jim Carrey. And I had a friend there, Hugh Fink, who was on staff there. And I had submitted 5, 10 sketch packages to the show by then. I knew a few people. And so I was hired as a guest writer for 2 episodes. It was the first season I don't know what year it was, the first season of Will Ferrell. And so after that, I got some sketches on and I did the monologue with Jim Carrey and the one with Christine Baranski. And then I was hired the next season, but I couldn't go. Here's the crazy thing about living in New York is that it would be very hard to survive there with a family of four on the guild minimum. You know, you could probably do it and people do it, but I was making more money in LA working on a sitcom at that point. So I had to turn down my dream job. I'm not over it. It was very hard to say no to that. And then Lorne Michaels said, "What's the real reason that Tom didn't come here?" And Hugh explained it was because the money, he couldn't afford it. And he goes, "It's never about the money," but it was 100% about the money. I don't think I could have afforded to live there.
Wow. Part of that is heartbreaking. My God.
Oh, but, I know. Yeah. It really is. But, you know, I think I made the right choice because, you know, I worked a couple of years on some sitcoms and then I don't love sitcoms. I like The Simpsons, which is satire of the sitcom while being a sitcom. So I asked my agent, Jay Suris, at the time at UTA, I said, "Can you get me on at The Simpsons?" It was after my second season at Naked Truth with Taya Leone. And it was a bit of a dysfunctional show. And sitcoms just seemed kind of dumb at that point. It just predictable and not my cup of tea. So I asked Jay if he could get me on and he said, "They're not hiring." And I said, "Can you just try?" And he got me a meeting and with Mike Scully and he liked my spec and we hit it off and he hired me immediately. I couldn't believe it.
Wow. That's amazing. Can I ask what the spec was about?
It was, I worked on the first six episodes of Just Shoot Me and I wrote a episode called Secretary's Day featuring Spade, who gets pissed off that everyone keeps saying happy Secretary's Day to him. And he considers himself an executive assistant, not a lowly secretary. So that the first draft of that was my spec for that. And it was packed full of jokes and it had a little funny story. So, but I also think at that point, we probably knew a ton of the same people because Mike did a little bit of stand-up too. And he was coming from a different perspective than the traditional showrunner at The Simpsons, which was pure intellectual giant Harvard genius with 5 degrees. It's usually the people at the, and Scully was, he jokes about being a dropout at the junior college. He went to college for a month and his brilliance comes from life experience. And I mean, if you read his writing, it's sharper and funnier than any of the guys who got perfect scores on the SAT. So I think that perhaps we had something in common that we weren't that engaged by school, but maybe under different circumstances, we might be considered smart.
What was that Einstein quote? If you judge a goldfish by their ability to climb a tree, you'll always think they're idiots.
That's good. I like that.
Yeah. Please feel free to take it. I mean, Einstein won't mind. He's dead. So.
He won't care.
Yeah.
But what about you? Were you good at school? You look like you're smart.
Thank you. I think. I'm definitely one of those people who was like, I got to get the perfect grade. I got to get the perfect grade in order to like, you know, cause that's going to set you up for life. At least that's the narrative that a lot of people get told. So I, you know, did the whole thing in high school, took AP classes, and then I went to Chapman Film School for a couple of years until I eventually transferred to USC Film School and I graduated there. Yeah.
And you know, that feeling you describe that you've got to get a perfect score, do well, I get that now. I never had it with school, but I get it with a script. I totally get it. Like, I can't, this isn't good enough yet. This is, so I do know exactly what you're talking about. It just didn't hit me until later in life. And maybe it was the idea that someone's paying me for this. And then for that reason, I have to make it as good as I can possibly make it.
Oh yeah, that's well, let me ask, is it because does it come from a place of fear or a sense of approval, or where do you think that stems from?
That's a good question, and I think it's definitely fear and neediness in equal amounts, but also I think a huge amount of insecurity about like, in order to keep up with these writers that I was thrown in with and learned with. I mean, I had to work 4 or 5 times harder just to get up to their level. Now, I think I've closed the gap in the last 30 years or 20, whatever it is.
I would agree. Yeah.
But at the same time, I still have that feeling of, I see all the flaws in it. All I see is what's wrong with it. And I think that I worry that they'll see it too. And then to answer your question, I don't know. I hadn't thought about it before, but what if they do? Now, for me, I guess I would think, oh, that's it for me. But really what they might think is, oh, maybe we can improve this little part right here, rather than think that the whole thing is useless. I guess one of the things I notice in a script that's not working is how scripts either work or they don't work. It's almost like it's either or, and if it's not working in one spot, it's not working. Every bit of it needs to be pulling in the same direction and supporting itself, unless you're making the choice for it not to be doing that in a part, but then it's still doing that just in a different way. So I like everything. I guess I don't feel comfortable until a script is super tight in all of those ways that show a script is working.
It's interesting that you bring up the idea of like all pulling in one direction, because something I've heard a lot lately is, do you know the YouTuber Patrick H. Willems?
I don't think so.
He's really good, and he does a lot of good video essays, but I've learned from his channel that people like Francis Ford Coppola and Kurt Vonnegut, in order to keep their stories focused, they will boil down the story down to a single thought, and in some cases even a single word, and run all of their decisions through that one word filter, if you will. So it was really fascinating to
see that. Yeah, I like that. Yeah. That's really good. Because I think sometimes we have parallel themes running in a story that seem supportive and are almost the same, but aren't exactly the same. So if you have like 3 or 4 big thematic statements that are similar, it's like you're writing 3 or 4 scripts simultaneously. They're very similar to each other.
Yeah.
It's a lot of work. But I don't know. Sometimes there's no solution other than just to spin the wheel on the clay and figure out which one of those is the most worthwhile.
I'm curious. So what was your favorite part about working on The Simpsons?
Well, I guess that, I mean, I've always been a fan of sports, and I like participating in sports, and I didn't give a lot of, or it wasn't important growing up or made to be important to me as far as like book learning or intellectual pursuits. And I guess what I was most blown away by is just how brilliant all of these people were. I mean, these were just some of the best minds these are some of the best writers in writing at the time. And I guess I was coming from stand-up, so I was sharp in a way that maybe they weren't as aware of. Mm-hmm. Or, and I think stand-ups tend to have their ear to the ground in a way that other people don't, as far as what comedy is brewing out there. But what has really impressed me is just how brilliant and funny and smart and educated and how effortless it was for them. I remember there was a New York Times article that listed the 100 best American novels, and all these guys are going through it, and it was all dudes in this conversation. There were three women writers there at the time, but in this conversation, it was all guys mm-hmm. Who either went to Harvard or Brown or Columbia or Penn. And almost all of them had read every book on this list. Like, they're even fast readers.
Mm. Wow.
I think I had read maybe 10 or 12 of them, but they, yeah. So I guess it was just a different perspective on life and how, what a great tool it is to have a really strong, well-functioning, brilliant mind, but mm-hmm. also being funny. Because a lot of these people that their classmates probably just went to Wall Street and were mm-hmm. rather than using their great gifts to make people laugh or build a bridge or whatever, mm-hmm. doctors. I mean, any one of these people could have been anything. A lot of them had two of the guys had law degrees from Harvard after graduating there. Dan Graney and Rich Appel.
Mm-hmm. Conan O'Brien was gone by this time, right?
Yeah, he had left by then. But Al Jean and Mike Rees and Max Pross and Tom Gamble and George Meyer and these guys were so funny. I mean, it was like I was at a comedy show in the audience uh-huh. with the really with the best comedy minds around just cracking each other up all day. So I know I'm painting a rosier picture than it was, but it really was like that a lot, especially with Mike Scully running it, because mm-hmm. he had five kids and him and his wife liked to have a normal life. Julie Thacker, who was also a writer on the show. Mm. So he ran it on a schedule rather than the typical way of, you know, pissing away 3 hours somewhere along the way and then getting notes and then getting dinner and then getting going about 6 p.m. and working till 2 a.m.
Yeah. And while you were there, you actually got promoted to a position of supervising producer in addition to writing. Can I ask, what did that entail on The Simpsons?
That's really just rank. You know, you go in there and I guess I had done enough time as a staff writer and then is for live action mm-hmm. you're staff writer, and then you're like story editor, and then you're executive story editor, and you're co-producer, mm-hmm. then producer, and then supervising producer, then a co-executive producer, and then executive producer. Really mm-hmm. it just you might get more responsibility, but for the most part that's just in the contract. And more, if they pick you up, they call you something that sounds better, but you're really just doing mostly the same job.
That is actually nice to hear, because a lot of the jobs I've worked at, like in order to get a bumping credit, you know, you wind up having to do like the same position, like the two positions at the same time. And that's, right. Yeah.
Yeah. I think when you're really running things, I was always just, you know, I don't think I was ever going to leapfrog the 20 guys that mm-hmm. were ahead of me at The Simpsons. But in other shows, when you get a more position of running things, you do have more of that, where you're like recording episodes and mm-hmm. rewriting stuff and late at night fixing things or even making casting decisions. But that that's about it though. There's like basically, regardless of your title, you're either just a writer in a room who occasionally gets scripts, or you're just being, you have that grinding job of making sure everything is working. And that's a big difference. It's hard to explain how different that is, because you don't, if it's going to be recorded, everything really has to be perfect. It isn't enough that like, all right, it's working pretty good. Now it really has to work.
So while you were there, and this will be my last Simpsons question, I promise.
I don't mind.
Okay. So while you were there, like what episodes did you write, or what contributions did you make that you were most proud of?
Well, there's so many writers. And at the time, John Schwartzwalder was given like 5 scripts a year to work at home and write, because he didn't want to give up smoking. He didn't want to be in the room. So he was so funny, they just let him write from home. Mm-hmm. So it was hard to get a script. I got, my first script was written in the room. It was an idea by Donna Carey about a Super Bowl episode. And we wanted to really push it forward in the schedule. Normally it would have taken a long time, but we wanted to hit the Super Bowl. So it was Mike Scully, his brother Brian Scully, George Meyer, and me just banged out a draft in the room over maybe the course of a week or two. And then we did a quick pass of it in the room, and then we did a table read and cast. So that was my first credited writing episode. Meanwhile, like, we all contribute to each other's episodes in that brutal rewrite process. And I was there for some well-known episodes, the famous Trump episode written by Dan Graney, Trump as president, which was just a throwaway joke, but turned out to make everyone think that we can see into the future. But that,
which you can.
In the next season, I forget which one. There was one where Marge was an art teacher at a prison, and then she sponsored a parole guy who painted a mural on the school. And then there was one, a Christmas one, where way ahead of its time, corporations were paying the school district to get the kids to do research on toys. Anyway, you know, it's so long. It's weird how I just, all these fragments of these episodes, I can't even remember them.
Understandable. So you were there for like 3 years. And then after that, you started, you left, and then you started to transition to other shows, including ones that you wrote and produced on, including Still Standing and Todd's Coma. I'm curious how those came about.
Let's see. I think before Still Standing, I went pretty much directly over to, well, actually, I had a development deal with Disney, which is really just a blind script deal where I was paid to write a pilot that didn't get made. And then meanwhile, I was working at a show called Clone High, which was the funniest show I ever worked on, maybe, but it got canceled right away for, we had a character based on Gandhi that made the entire country of India furious. So they fasted in protest until Viacom canceled it. But now it's back. And this was created by Phil Lord and Chris Miller, who went on to some other great endeavors. And now, even though they canceled it here, the Nelvana, the Canadian animation company, had rights to Canada. So they just ran it for 2 years nonstop, and it developed a little following. And but that show was hilarious. And then when that got canceled, a huge disappointment. I went to a regular sitcom again called was it Still Standing, right? That's the one that, and I worked there for a year. Then I can't remember what happened. Oh wait, did I work? I worked at a show called, somewhere in there, I worked at another sitcom called, with Nikki Cox, that was about, I think it was called Nikki, maybe. I don't know. I worked there for a year. But those were, after that, I just wanted to be in animation. And, you know, I did some feature writing, rewriting, and I can't remember, there may be another sitcom in there. But really, after working at The Simpsons and Clone High, I just felt like animation was a better fit. And whereas sitcoms just felt like unappealing to me at that point, it just seemed like very easy insult jokes. It just seemed like a bunch of characters saying stuff that they would never say to each other in real life without destroying their friendships, you know, just didn't feel right. Whereas I think in animation, and eventually even in younger kids animation, it just feels more real, even though it's cartoons, because you're dealing with more interesting or more important themes, and it's not just relationship stuff and insult comedy.
You raise a very interesting point, because, like, well, first off, I have to laud you and the other writers on the show that made a show so offensive that the entire nation of India protested.
Oh my gosh. It was because they're in the process of turning Gandhi into Jesus, you know, for the next So I didn't realize that, because we had at Clone High is basically a high school full of clones. Mm-hmm. And so the main characters were Abe Lincoln, Gandhi, Joan of Arc, Cleopatra, and JFK. And it was basically just a satire of Dawson's Creek. But there was, Jesus was a one-off character, and we were worried more about that, but we didn't know that portraying Gandhi as a dude who just liked to party and has ADD, and he's just he had a kid with regular problems, just that wanted to be popular, and they're deifying him. So but at the time, the show was huge. It was like, it was taking off. There was a feeling of like, this is the next South Park, but we weren't South Park yet, because South Park could get away with this stuff, but Viacom didn't know what this show was. And that's one of the problems at the time. Like, I remember having the discussion that, see, this is the problem with media consolidation. It hurts the freedom of expression, because now these executive at Viacom don't know this show, and they've canceled it. So they don't, because the government of India had threatened to cancel MTV India and all other Viacom properties going on in India, you know, a billion customers there.
Right.
So, I mean, we were canceled before they even hung up the phone. It was just like, get rid of these guys. So, but it's funny looking back from now, and even more media consolidation. I mean, Disney owns Fox. It was not even nearly as consolidated as it became. So anyway, yeah, so that was, we pissed off the entire government of India without even realizing it.
That is truly remarkable. And then I was curious about, like, your experience in executive producing these other shows, Todd's Coma and Still Standing. Was it a positive experience, or was it?
Yeah, I think I would say all of my shows have been a positive experience. I think that Still Standing, I had a lot of good friends there. But it was the moment where I think I realized that I think there was a point where, like, there's not enough money in the world for me to want to sit through another hour of being in a regular sitcom writer's room. And it's just dumb. You know what I mean? It's like, it just doesn't connect with me. I wouldn't watch the show on my own. And so you get to the point where you have ideas that you think are worth sharing, and scripts you want to do that would excite you. So I really tried to transition to something that was more satisfying creatively. And so with Todd's, I think that I got somewhere along that, in that era, I was working on I was the head writer on the David Spade show for Comedy Central. And from there, Todd Glass had a show that was set up. I forget where it was.
Mm-hmm.
But the guy who was running that show quit. And so I got fired from the Spade show for reasons that weren't my fault. But mm-hmm. first head writer often does get fired as they find the show. And so I went over to Todd Glass's, Todd's Coma, where I think we made a really funny pilot. I think you can even watch it on YouTube somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
But then while we were doing that, the entire leadership there, all the executives were fired and they went a completely different direction for mm-hmm. their network. So Todd's show never got the chance it deserved. But that started a series of jobs that even goes on right now, where I just found myself taking jobs where I would go into a troubled show mm-hmm. and then kind of right the ship. Mm-hmm. So I went to an animated PBS show called Word Girl.
I was going to ask about that because I'm very familiar with that show. Yeah.
Yeah. So a very funny guy. The guy is a way better writer than me, Jack Ferriola, who created the show. This is not saying anything bad about him. He was in Boston doing the job of 10 people on his own without realizing it. Oof. And so I think that he couldn't keep up with the demand. So they mm-hmm. shut it down for a while. And they hired me to be the head writer in LA. So I just started gathering writers. And he was using children's television writers, which in general were the wrong choice for this particular show. I mean, this show was written in the same way that you'd write a more grown-up show. Mm-hmm. It wasn't really soft. It was really just, it was Batman, the TV show, with words simplified down for kids.
Mm-hmm.
But it was really a funny show. So I hired mostly people who'd never written in children's television and just made it more appropriate for the age group. It was really packed with jokes and funny characters.
Mm-hmm.
And even the educational part of that show was wedged in there in a funny way. So I worked there for seasons, 2, 3, 4.
Mm-hmm.
Then I left for season 5. I think they tried to pay someone less. The show crashed again. I came back for season 7 and 8. Mm-hmm. And then that was the last season. But we won 3 or 4 or 5 Emmys there. I can't remember where I went from there. But my most recent job of running things, I created this show in Europe based on an app called Talking Tom. And Disney tried to turn it into a show, and then they had some Spanish company and it was going poorly. And this was right when Word Girl was ending. So it was a turnkey operation. I just mm-hmm. used the same writers and actors to do this Talking Tom show, which I think we did 200 or 300 episodes that are on YouTube. I think it's on Netflix. More people watch it than watch The Simpsons. It's insane. It's like a massive global hit. It's in every language. And it's another one where it appears to be a kid's show, but if you watch an episode, you'll realize that it's way funnier than your average primetime live action sitcom, across the board. It's just better in every way a show can be better.
I did actually watch an episode in preparation for this interview, and you're absolutely right. I was struck by how technology-based it was, which now knowing that it was based on an app explains why. It has a lot of really good character arcs and twists within an episode. And it's funny. It's really funny with really unexpected jokes.
It just gets better. I don't know, the episodes you watch, the early ones were a little tight. They were a little bit Not right, but we had such great actors. I mean, we had Maria Bamford and we had James Domian, Colin Hanks. I mean, so many people were so good. And the writers we got were all just fantastic. And we did it on just a shoestring budget that we only were able to do it because I had all the pieces in place already.
That is incredible. And I'm got to ask, like, as far as, you know, since you're the head writer on these shows and the executive producer on the other two I mentioned, like, what is that process like maybe working on those shows compared to The Simpsons? How do you manage a writer's
difference writer? Is I get to be the final say of what goes into a script as far as the official draft. So you get to run the room, which is a lot more fun than being one of 10 people in the room. I always keep the room about 5 writers and a writer's assistant who's also a writer, because then everyone has to pay attention. It's easy to doze off if there's too many people. So less is more in that case, but that's more fun than being a writer, because you get to pick what makes you laugh the most or is the most entertaining to you, which keeps you engaged. Whereas if you're just one of the, it's easy to just check your phone or like stare out the window for a while.
Oh, that's great. And then how do you go about managing a writer's room, since, you know, if you've got 10 people in the room, you're in charge for wrangling them. So how do you, what's your process for that?
Well, I think at the very beginning, you have an optimistic schedule. If everything goes perfectly, this is how we're going to hit our marks. Mm-hmm. They almost never manage there. So you put a couple of accordion weeks in there where you can catch up. Mm-hmm. And then you start dividing up the whole season of, before you know what the show is, you're going to know who's going to write them. So that kind of schedules who's there. Mm-hmm. And then you just meet and we had an office and we meet, we break stories. We had some people from the app company in Europe that came to contribute for what they wanted and didn't want. Mm-hmm. And then you start outlining stories together, and then you send someone off to write a draft, and then you rewrite it. It's really an assembly line. There's so many things like going at different levels. And so it takes a certain amount of discipline to manage all the tasks wherever they are. There could be 8 scripts in various stages of production at any time, from outline to record draft. So you just have to keep those just moving down the line, the whole thing collapses. But I think that's where getting good people engaged in the process. I mean, we had 2 of the best unknown writers that I've discovered that I use for everything I do, Jamie Woodham and Matt Gossin, and my daughter, Erica Martin, too. She's good, too. And so many others. And then I eventually quit talking Tom because it was just too much work and it was ready. He didn't need me anymore. And so this guy, Kevin Peterson, who I have hired for everything that I could before he became, didn't need me to hire him anymore. So he took over the show towards the end. And I think he still works for the company. So that's another thing that happens to a lot of shows, I think, is maybe you can only handle so many years of it, and then you want to pass it on to somebody and get the hell out of there and take a nap.
that's fantastic. And it's funny because this season of the podcast, I wanted to talk specifically with people who had served as writers and producers on TV shows, in particular kids shows, because I've found there's a lot of egalitarianism and kind of like cordiality, and it's not cutthroat and it's not toxic, like you mentioned with some traditional sitcom writers' rooms.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's a really good observation, because I think that just like the characters in your average sitcom behave in a toxic way, in an insulting way, that's not going on in the same way. And so maybe the writers aren't influenced by the jokes they're pitching as much, because it's always been, it's been very pleasant there in my experience for the three shows, well, two shows, children's animated shows that I worked with. Everybody was great. Everybody got along, and it was not toxic. It was very much. And I think the part of that reason is my philosophy going into this, and I think that is probably the philosophy of most children's television, is first do no harm, you know? Yeah. I mean, and then, you know, okay, at least if it's not worthwhile for the kid to watch, at least make it entertaining and not damaging in any way. And then what I like about children's television, not preschool, but like a little bit older, maybe like whatever they break it down, 5 to 8 to 9 to 10, you can let the theme lead a little more without seeming preachy. They're willing to engage in issues that maybe older kids, not that they don't want to hear about it, but maybe are moving past that. I mean, I think that any good script should be having some worthwhile theme, but for children's television, it's the best part of children's television is the ability to lay in an important message about that will help them in some way be happy and successful and a good citizen in life, you know, rather than just a half hour of babysitting with moving colors. You know, I like it to have something worthwhile there.
Right, right. That's, yeah, I agree. Let me ask, does that philosophy affect what you look for when hiring a young writer?
Yeah, you know, I don't know if I do consciously. Mm-hmm. I think that maybe the people that I respond to are probably like that too, but they're not soft in a way. Like I hired some people that maybe would never write for children's television because they're like too edgy, or too, the subject matter that interests them isn't funny, but I still have gotten good stuff out of people like that, because there's a way to make those adjustments so it is age appropriate. So I think what the people that I respond to are just like, I think, really good, funny writers. And it's interesting that the people that I've working with in the last few years have been what they call millennials. I don't know what a millennial is, but it's weird to think how sometimes they get this reputation of being not working. And every person that I've hired in the from the mid-20s to mid-30s has, I would describe as a workaholic who has two or three jobs and hustling and going above and beyond. You know, because I think that a lot of people, it was just harder to make a living. You had to seem to have two jobs or going that extra mile. So do you find that at all? Like there's a bad rap out there?
Absolutely. Like I consider myself a millennial. Like I think the rough, you know, age range is people born from 1980 to 1995. And I absolutely have the hustling thing that I'm doing, this podcast, for example. It's kind of ridiculous.
It is ridiculous. Everybody's got two or three jobs. Everyone's hustling their ass off to make it. anyway, that's what I found to be the case with these the workers that the writers that I have. And mm-hmm. these writers are way better than I was at their age, maybe better than me now in many ways. And they're not getting the breaks either. Mm-hmm. It seems harder to make it now for some reason. I mean, especially this last few years, a lot of moving back home and like, it is a really rough time right now out there. That's my sense.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I've heard a lot of the same thing from my friends. A lot of people who came to LA, tried to make it, and then they had to move back to Connecticut or wherever, you know?
Yeah. Well, so, I moved to Colorado a few years ago and I've been able to manage it okay. Nice. And I mean, the stuff I do right now, like I did a voice record yesterday for a Clash-O-Rama Christmas special mm-hmm. for the Clash of Clans app. But even if I were in LA, I would have been doing it over a Zoom connection. So it doesn't even matter where you live in the same way anymore. I know that if you're working on a sitcom or a show with a writer's room, then you got to be there. But there's a ton. I'm doing more work than I can handle just from my office in Colorado.
Right, right. And since you're in Colorado, let me ask, and now that you're at this point in your career, what interests do you try to have outside of writing to try and keep a balanced life? Like I've heard one really good approach is make sure that you have friends or your main circle of friends are outside of the entertainment industry, because there winds up being a conflict eventually if they are.
Yeah, I think that's really sound advice. Where I became a volunteer firefighter here in Colorado. So that's like being in the Eagle Scouts, where you just get all these badges and Ice Water Rescue, Swift Water Rescue, Fire One. I got a wild. I was deployed to two different wildfires for two weeks. Wow. That's really awesome. Plus, I have mm-hmm. Four grandchildren down the street, Mike. But yeah, you're right. It's like you want to have something outside of writing because, I started collecting my Writers Guild pension. I've pretty much, I don't try to get jobs anymore. I only take them if they come my way, which is a much better way to operate, because my whole life is just so desperately like, I got to make a living. I can't have my kids homeless. So there's this intense hustling early on, but the Writers Guild years ago was set up in a good way where you could start collecting your pension once the business is sick of you in a big way. So you don't have to wait till you're 65. You can get less if you take it when, earlier. So I took it a couple years ago when I was 52, which makes it a little easier to get by. It's not a huge amount, but at least it helps and it allows you to not lose your dignity calling everyone you know, trying desperately to get a script.
I only have one last question, and what is your favorite philosopher?
I've been doing a lot of reading of this guy, Krishnamurti, and he was a theosophist. I think that's what it called, which is sort of, I don't know much about it other than it seems to be a lot of what he talks about has a lot of crossover with Buddhism. And that I think that he's probably not a quote that would fill the answer the question, because I think that what he thinks is that words, thoughts, and images become barriers to your experience of reality. So even by saying that, I've created a barrier to the concept that he tries to get, which is this sense, if you can strip your mind of these words, thoughts, and images, the thing that is left is the good part of you, the part that isn't corrupted by the ego or conditioning. And if you can live in that spot as much as possible, you can be connected in the right way of living with everything around you. So it's not exactly a quote, but it's something that helps me, and it's something that I sometimes try to put into scripts, even though scripts are full of words.
And that is Season 2, Episode 5 of the Producers Lounge Podcast. Thank you to my guest, Tom Martin, for joining us. You can find out more about him by checking out the show notes and visiting our website, greaterandgrander.com. Our intro and outro music today was Menil Montant by Lachey Swing. Our episode still image is by Ricardo Tomas on Greater and Grander. If you have any questions or suggestions, we'd love to hear from you. Let us know in the episode comments. You can stay up to date by following us on social media at the handle Greater Grander, all one word. Join us next week for more cocktails and questions, and until then, keep producing dreams.